Dr. Gonzalez now teaches at the Astronomy and Physics Department at Louisiana State University. She earned her PhD back in 1995 in Syracuse and has spent a good portion of her career working on the LIGO experiments. LIGO is the Laser Interferometer Gravity Wave Observatory. And among many awards that she has won the Edward A. Boucher Award for significant contributions to the field of gravitational waves. Dr. Gabriela Gonzalez.
Thank you very much. Thank you to the Perimeter Institute for inviting me to give this lecture. It is a big, big pleasure to be here again. I've been here before, and I was always impressed, not just about the science, but also the outreach efforts at the Perimeter Institute. And I am even more impressed today to see this audience here. I wanted to tell you today about Einstein's waves, about how we are planning to catch them in action, and how, in the process, we're going to be detecting how black holes are born. So I hope you're all as excited, you end up this lecture as excited about this as I am. Let me tell you first about Einstein, but before Einstein, let me start with Newton. This is all about gravity, and you probably remember that Newton was the one who invented the first law of gravity, saying that gravitational forces were forces between anything that had masses, and those forces were proportional, inversely proportional to the square of the distance and proportional to the masses of the objects. And now, we all think this is all boring and natural now, but at the time it was revolutionary because this not only explained the experiment that we usually think about how an apple is falling and how things are falling attracted by the Earth, but it also explains that everything that has mass attracts each other, so it also explained just as mundane things as apples falling on the Earth as the motion of the Earth around the Sun and the motion of the Moon around the Earth. It explained the motion of the stars out there and the planets. So that was amazing. It was a single universal law that explained all of these things. It was the first time of many times in physics where laws were unifying different fields and making, answering some questions, but again producing even more questions that, that we are still dealing with. One of those questions is, this assumes that these forces are going to travel instantaneously. And then Einstein came later, and he said, well, there's a speed limit. Things don't travel faster than the speed of light. And that's something he concluded when studying his special theory, inventing this special theory of relativity that was a great success. But then he said, well, that's incompatible with this Newton's theory because gravity forces cannot travel faster than the speed of light. And that's when he began working on what we call now the general theory of relativity. And it was a lot of math, even for him. It was a difficult math to follow, even for me in graduate school and many of us. It is difficult math, but now we can sort of understand it. But even then, even a year after coming up with this theory of general relativity, he said, there's a very important consequence of this theory. This theory says that the forces are not such thing. There are no forces between masses. What there is a space-time. That space-time is deformed by masses, and it is masses looking for the easiest way to travel in that deformed space-time that makes them move. So it was this interaction between masses and space-time what made the theory of relativity. And that explained, for example, how two masses attract each other, how they move around. It also explains how a satellite moves around the star, so it explains just as well Newton's theory. It explains not just why things attract each other, why masses attract each other, but it explains the motion of the planets, everything that Newton explained. But there was this new consequence. If you have two masses that are moving around each other because they are deforming the space-time, those ripples in space-time are going to move away. and they're going to carry energy with them. And those are gravitational waves that are going to carry energy away from the system. And these two stars that Newton thought would go around each other forever, Einstein said, they're going to get closer and closer together. It was a very different prediction than anything about Newton's theory for these for the motion of masses in space-time. So it is those ripples in space-time, the ones we want to catch, the ones we want to detect. And that's what we call gravitational waves. So the prediction of Einstein's theory was not only everything that Newton predicted, but in a way that made it compatible with this speed limit to the interactions, but it also had new predictions. This wasn't the only one. You probably know that he also predicted that light deflects around the star, and that's how it was first confirmed. And it had many other predictions, like the creation of the existence of black holes, which nobody believed in the beginning, and then later it was proven true, and now we use all the time in astronomy. So there were many predictions, but this was one that was very different in nature because it talked about space-time being deformed. Now, when people put numbers together, it was clear that this was a very, very small effect. Space-time gets wrinkled, but it's very, very stiff. So these things are not easy to detect. But the question is also, who produces, what systems can produce these deformations? We are talking about a binary system of stars, and you will learn that that's my favorite system, but it's not the only one. Gravitational waves in general will come from stars. That's not the only system. I like to say that I like to move my arms when giving talks, so I am producing gravitational waves around him. Anything that moves with that's not completely spherical, and I hope you think I'm not completely spherical, and that is moving with some acceleration will produce gravitational waves, but those are going to be just infinitesimal and very, very difficult to measure. And of course, a bit boring too. I mean, who wants to know how I move? But the interesting systems are the stars and galaxies and black holes that are moving, that have a lot of mass moving very, very fast. So that's how we connect gravitational waves and the general theory of relativity with astrophysics. So what out there is producing gravitational waves that we might look for? Supernova explosions is one example. You know that it is well known that many stars collapse, and when they have what we call a core collapse, then there's an explosion and a neutron star or a supernova is born. There's about one per 50 years or per 100 years per galaxy, and we haven't seen one in our galaxy in a long time, although now people think that we may not have seen it because it actually happened on the other side of the galactic center, so we don't know. We don't have our galaxy as a very good laboratory in that sense. But that explosion, it is a lot of mass, it's moving very fast, and if it's not completely symmetrical, which we don't expect it to be, would produce gravitational waves. So that's one exciting source, and again, there could be a black hole or a neutron star being born. We know that many stars of these compact stars, neutron stars, they are the most compact stars other than black holes, rotate, and we know that because we receive, they often emit radio beams, and we detect those radio beams in Earth if we are lucky and they are pointing towards us. We call those stars pulsars, and from these radio beams, we know that they rotate. And we know that because of X-ray images and many images from the radio pulses, but also from X-ray images. It turns out that also we can do the calculation. And if these stars are not spherically symmetric, if they're not perfect spheres, they will emit gravitational waves at the frequency, at twice the frequency, actually, that they are rotating. So it should be easy to find because it's like a sine wave, right? It turns out that these stars are very, very symmetric. The mountains on these stars are less than a part in a million of the radius of these stars. And these stars are only the size of, actually smaller than the size of Toronto, probably the size of Waterloo and Guelph together, tens of kilometers. So those are exciting sources of gravitational waves. I told you that my favorite source are these binary systems. We know they exist. We know they exist because a few of them have these radio beams that point to us. And from those radio signals, we can tell that there's a companion, usually a dark companion. And we know that they are emitting gravitational waves. And we know that those they are going to be losing energy. So they're going to get closer and closer and coalesce and form a black hole. In this case, you will have two neutron stars that will form a black hole, or a neutron star and a black hole. So these, actually, we know they exist. We more or less know how often they coalesce within a galaxy, about once per 10,000 years. So we haven't seen one in our galaxy coalescing, but we have seen them losing energy while rotating far away. Now, this movie I'm showing you here shows these nice ripples in space-time. But it is an artistic simulation of a binary system with a pulsar. Now, a simulation that's a lot more real. And this simulation was made here at the Perimeter Institute. That's not the only reason why I like showing it, but it is a real simulation that uses Einstein's equations to predict how these gravitational waves are formed, in this case, by a neutron star orbiting around the black hole and getting all distorted from it. This is Louis Leonard, one of the scientists here at Perimeter Institute that produced that movie. There are also very other very nice movies, but the science was too complicated in those for me to follow even. And this one was very colorful, so I liked it. I think he's around here. So you can ask him more questions about it. But we do have now good calculations of these gravitational waves, of the amplitudes of these gravitational waves. So we do have sources of these. And these are not the only ones. Another very exciting one is the origin of the universe. You probably have heard about this map that I'm showing you, that it's a map of the cosmic microwave background that we have been measuring more and more precisely with the years, first with the COBE satellite, then with the WMAP satellite. And we know that in the beginning of the universe, everything was very isotropic, but not completely isotropic. And those are the anisotropies that we measure in the microwave background that tell us about the origin of the galaxies. Now, this is what we learned from the electromagnetic spectrum. The gravitational spectrum, the gravitational waves that would have been produced at the beginning of the universe would tell us about even earlier times in the universe. And we would know about these not from measuring gravitational waves in one detector at Earth, but we need several measuring correlations. Sometimes we're trying to do this, and I say we, as all scientists, but not me personally, looking at the radio signals that come from different pulsars and seeing distortions in space-time from the way those radio signals travel to us. So there's a lot of exciting science in astrophysics that we can learn from gravitational waves. Now, the question is how to detect them, how to measure them, and that's what I'm going to tell you about. I'm going to tell you about one of the methods that we use, and of course, I think it's the most promising because I work in it, but, but it's not the only method to work for gravitational waves. There are many different windows in gravitational waves, just like in the electromagnetic spectrum, and this method will give you one window, but a very important one, in the universe. So we are going to use interferometers. Interferometers have been used for many precision experiments, in particular, to try to detect ether by Michelson and Morley in 1880, which when they failed to detect, and the idea of ether seemed to be contradicted by experiment, gave rise to the special theory of relativity, at least in Einstein's mind. So it is a very well-known method of measuring very, very precisely, not lengths, but differences in lengths. So the idea of an interferometer is that you have a laser beam, and that laser beam is split in two by a beam splitter. and then the light is split in two, travels one way that in that direction and the other way in this direction. It's bounced by a mirror. It comes back to the beam splitter. When it comes back to the beam splitter, this beam splits in two again. This beam splits in two again. So now you have two beams coming out and two beams going back to the laser. It turns out that if these two lengths are exactly the same, up to an integer number of wavelengths of the laser, then there is no light in here. But if there is a difference between these two lengths, then you see light in this photodetector. So the amount of light that you see in the photodetector is proportional, if you have everything operating right, is proportional to the difference in length of these two lengths, and that is exactly what a gravitational wave would do. It turns out that gravitational waves change lengths, but they change them in what we call a quadrupolar way, which means that if it makes this distance shorter, it will make that distance longer. So an interferometer is what we think a very, very good way of doing this. Now, how good should these interferometers be? Well, I told you that binary neutron star systems are my favorite system, and not just mine, many people. So what we need to know is how sensitive our interferometer needs to be if it's going to detect gravitational waves for example, these binary neutron star systems. Now, I told you that in our galaxy, these systems coalesce about once per 10,000 years. So that's too long to wait. We have to look them farther away. So let's think about a radius that includes the next clusters of galaxies, the Virgo cluster, about 30 megaparsecs away, about 100 million light years away. So if we think about the number of systems in that volume, which is not that many, I mean, those coalesce once every 50 or 100 years, about the same rate as supernovas, but still, that's a more reasonable number. So how strong would those gravitational waves be? They will be strongest just before the coalescence of them, and those frequencies will be a few hundred hertz, a few 100 times a second. So we have a frequency. The amplitude of these gravitational waves says that if this is the sun and that's the Earth, so if you put a laser in the sun and bounce it on the Earth and bounce it again on another Earth down here, so this is a very big solar system interferometer, then the difference of length that you could measure, the difference of length between these two lengths would be one atomic diameter. And this effect is proportional to length. So if you make the distance longer, for example, measuring fluctuations of distances to pulsars, that's one way to make the distance longer, then the change in distance is larger and a bit easier to detect. If you make the distance shorter, like for example, to put an interferometer like this in your lab, or at least on Earth, then you have to measure distances that are much, much, much smaller. For this binary neutron star system I was talking in the Virgo cluster, 100 million light years away, then that 30 million light years away, that system would produce on an interferometer that's 4 kilometers long on the side, a change in length at a few hundred hertz that is 10 to the minus 19 meters. Now, I know this is a very, very educated audience, but I don't expect to keep all these numbers in your head. Does anybody remember how small an atom is? More or less, that's a change in length if this interferometer was one astronomical unit. So we are making this a few kilometers long, so 10 to the minus 19 meters is much, much smaller than one atomic diameter. So what's smaller than an atom? Well, let's think a proton. Does anybody remember how big a proton is? Which is even not even that well defined, but one can define the size of a proton, but that's 10 to the minus 15 meters. So on a 4 kilometer baseline, we need to measure, to detect these systems that don't happen that often, we need to measure a part in 10,000 of a proton diameter. Now, I know what you're all thinking, which is what many, many people thought, even people who thought it was difficult to spend money building detectors to do this. That's just impossible, right? Well, it turns out it's not. We have done that. We have built detectors that are, and not just one, several, I'll show you data. We've built detectors that do have this sensitivity on with 4 kilometer baselines. In the US, which is where I work, we have two observatories. Each of these two observatories has a 4 kilometer L-shaped Michelson facility that houses detectors, one in each facility now. The first facility is in Hanford, Washington, in the middle of a desert with a very nice desert landscape. The other one is in Livingston, Louisiana, in a small town, about a 45-minute drive from LSU, where I work. So that's why I live there. That's not the only thing, but that's the strongest reason why I love this place. In the middle of a logging forest. That logging causes some trouble to us. But these detectors were working for years at the sensitivity I just told you. We didn't detect anything. We took data for several years and we didn't detect anything, but we didn't expect to. I told you that the rate of coalescences for these systems is once per 50 or 100 years, so it wasn't so surprising. And it had never been promised to detect things. Even to the funding agencies at the very beginning, it was said that this was the first phase of a two-phase stage in which the advanced technology that needed to be 10 times better was the one that was going to be able to detect systems. Well, you can see it exists for real. That was my car. I have a nicer but still convertible car now. And this is a movie that the National Science Foundation produced.
In the heart of Louisiana, and in the high desert of Washington State, dedicated teams of scientists and engineers are undertaking one of the great technological challenges of the new century.
So the site exists. I mean, these are Google Maps. You can look them up in Google, and you'll find them. And you can watch the rest of the movie, which talks about science and not me driving the car. That's just to show that these sites are real. And here's more about how real they are. It is, as you imagine, a very, very difficult experiment. I have been working, like he said, since the early 90s. I finished my PhD in 95, already working on some of these things. You have to take care of everything in there. So it's not just a simple Michelson interferometer. It has quite a bit more complicated optical technology. The mirrors are not just simple mirrors that you bolt down to an optical table. It's mirrors that are suspended, few silica mirrors that are 40 kilograms heavy, suspended from another mirror, suspended from blades, to avoid seismic noise moving the mirror at the bottom, because you only want to detect fluctuations in length that are due to gravitational waves, not to seismic noise. On top of that, you have to use seismic isolation, which is a very sophisticated system that measures seismic noise and cancels it, also with several stages, in vacuum and outside the vacuum. These mirrors are actually housed in vacuum chambers. Those vacuum chambers are about 15 feet tall, and as I said, you see there the vacuum chamber that houses the seismic isolation system and this quadruple pendulum suspension, where at the bottom is the beam splitter. And you also see two other tall chambers there, because we don't just make the light go 4 kilometers and come back. We put a mirror in between those to make the light go back and forth many, many times to increase our sensitivity. That's how we get to 10 to the minus 19 meters. All of this is in vacuum. It's in a vacuum tube, about a meter in diameter, inside the vacuum enclosure, It's the laser that we use. It's a 200 watts laser that was produced in Germany. We do have many international, this is mostly funded by the National Science Foundation in the US, but there are many international partners. Our German partners were the ones that produced this laser. Our UK partners in Glasgow produced the design of that suspension system. So there are hundreds of people working on this from many different places. We do have these are not off-the-shelf devices. I mean, you have to make them at home. We do hire, of course, professional scientists and engineers that do all the design, but then to make them work at this sensitivity, these are one of a kind. They need to be done at home. So you have people like Ray Wise, Nergus Mavalvala, emeritus professor and current professor at MIT, working. And this is in the movie, but it's still real. They work on the photodetectors to make sure they have the sensitivity that we need. We do have a very sophisticated control room full of computers. We have lots of digital systems doing all the controls and the data acquisition to finally be able to measure what looks like noise. That's our signal. The way we measure gravitational waves in there is we have very sophisticated data analysis algorithms that look for gravitational waves, not just in one of these data streams from one detector, but coincident events at different detectors. That's how we know whether things are coming from space or they're coming from rabbits and deer bouncing off the walls of the enclosures, or trees being logged near Livingston. So it is a very difficult experiment that needs a lot of scientists and engineering doing everything at their very best. But as I told you, it worked. It worked at the sensitivity that was promised, not enough to measure gravitational waves yet, though. You can read more. I think I have mentioned a couple of times, or at least put it on the screen. If you go to LIGO.org, you can measure it. You can read a lot more. In particular, we are now producing a magazine, and the first issue of the magazine is focused on the technology of advanced LIGO. So please go there and read more. There are much nicer pictures in there. Now, I've told you about the LIGO detectors and the two LIGO observatories, but those are not the only ones in the world. There's actually a gravitational wave detector network with another shorter detector, so it's not as sensitive. Remember, length matters here. So this shorter detector, it's very short. It's only 600 meters long, which is not short at all. You know that 600 meters is not lab-sized, but it is a detector in which technologies, the most modern technologies have been tried, and those are the technologies that we are now using in another detectors. It's also the only detector that's currently running while all the other detectors are installing this advanced generation of technology. So we like it very, very much. That's called GEO-600. It's a UK-German collaboration. People working on GEO and the LIGO detectors are all members of what we call our dear LIGO scientific collaboration, of which Canada, University of Toronto, and Perimeter Institute are part of. We are 900 scientists around the world in 17 countries, more than 70 institutions. So we are all working on these detectors. But even these are not the only ones. There's another detector using similar technology, 3 kilometers long, so about as long as LIGO, in Italy. That's a French-Italian collaboration, although now they have Dutch partners too. And we have agreements with them to have to compare our data and analyze our data together. So this is something that I also like to mention. We are a very collaborative field. There are many fields in physics and other fields in science that are very competitive. And competition is good, don't get me wrong. I think competition helps to advance science and many fields. But in this case, collaboration is best because it is coincidence between signals we have in these detectors and sharing technology, at least until we get things going, that is going to produce the best science. We also have a Japanese partner, and we have just signed an agreement saying that when they have a detector, we will work with them again in a collaborative way. They are building, they don't have a detector yet, but they have a site. They're actually digging tunnels to build an underground detector. An underground is better because it has less seismic noise in the Kamiokande mine where the Super K detector, the Super K neutrino detector is. And I was there, and it's really very, very exciting. So this is a worldwide community. That's not the last one of the detectors. There is another one that is the most recently talked about, and it's also called LIGO, but it's in India. I told you, but you probably didn't absorb this because I'm talking and speaking very fast, but in the LIGO observatory, in the same vacuum system, we actually had two detectors. So LIGO operated three different detectors for several years. There were two detectors in the vacuum facility at Hanford. And these vacuum facilities are a big fraction of the cost. They are about $100 million a facility. So they are a big investment. But that's why in the same facility there were two detectors, because then you have coincidences and you can have more confidence in your detections. However, for a while we studied whether we could convince the Australian government to build a facility, such an observatory in Australia, to house this observatory from Hanford, because that gives us more sites to do better triangulation and know more about where the sources are coming from, which is what will allow us to do science by looking by all the other counterparts in telescopes, optical telescopes, X-ray telescopes. The Australian government, unfortunately, did not have the funds to do them. They had a difficult economy, a difficult time, other important science projects. But the Indian government, who had offered to be a partner of Australia in this endeavor, said, we could do this, and they are doing it. So India is building an observatory to house this observatory, this detector that was built by the National Science Foundation. So that detector is now being put in boxes to be shipped to India as soon as that observatory is ready. So the network is very, very exciting. I only told you about the LIGO Hanford and Livingston detector, but that's just one corner of the world. This is a very, very exciting field. The signal that we measure is like this. It looks like a very noisy signal. So how do you find gravitational waves in there? Well, the best way, there are many ways, but the best way to find them is to know what they look like and then find the match between what you expect and what you have in there, especially if you have several detectors. Now, that signal is much, much, much smaller than the noise. So even if you want to find a sine wave coming, for example, from a rotating star, the noise is going to be much, much larger. And I have used about a factor of million magnification in there, just for the signal not to be invisible. It still can be detected, but you need to integrate very carefully and look for this sine wave at all the different frequencies. So this particular problem about finding these periodic signals from rotating stars, especially when we don't know where the stars are and we want to look for all points in the sky, is computationally very, very expensive. So that's why I'm here asking you for help, because if you lend us your computers, we can use your spare cycles to look for those waves. And we have been doing this with many, many people. Is there anybody here who subscribes to Einstein at Home? Very good. There's a few. I hope that there's going to be a lot more of you after this talk. But you can look, you can help us look for gravitational waves in the data we have taken with the detectors, which we haven't analyzed it all yet, to be able to find these sources. So this is a very, very extensive project, not just from scientists, but from a whole community that built with their taxes these detectors, but also helps us look for these signals. Now, the important thing is, when is it that we're going to detect this? You probably guessed that we haven't detected anything yet, because I haven't mentioned that, and that would have been the highlight of the talk, right? So we have not detected, we haven't finished analyzing all the data we have, and some people here at Perimeter are still analyzing, looking for different sources in the data we have collected in the past. We collected data, as I mentioned, for several years, with a sensitivity, I told you, 10 to the minus 19 meters, that let us look as far as the Virgo cluster, actually farther if we were lucky and signals were well aligned. So that range in this map of clusters of galaxies is represented by this sphere that we call the initial LIGO reach. That was about 15, 20 megaparsecs at our best. We ran those between 2005 and 2011. As I told you, for these binary neutron star systems, which are the only ones for which we have some confidence in the prediction, we expected to see one per 50 years. We didn't see any. Well, we can set upper limits on how many there are out there, but it's not a big surprise. However, the advanced LIGO detectors, which are the pictures I showed you of those quadruple pendulums, that seismic isolation system, that laser, that is all being put in place now to form this advanced LIGO detector. Those advanced LIGO detectors will see 10 times farther. Now, if you see 10 times farther in distance, that means that you have a volume in your hand that's 1,000 times larger. So, and the frequencies that we will be sensitive to are also lower, so that also helps. So when we calculate our prediction for what will be our reach, our best reach will be about 600 million light years. We think that we will get there. Probably it will take several years until 2020 or so. But by 2016, we are very confident that we can be at about 300 million light years reach. And for that reach, we think that we will see several detections a year. For the 600 million light years, we expect to see 40 per year. Now, these are predictions. Predictions are often wrong, but this is the ballpark. So these gravitational waves are just around the corner. They're coming. And I hope that you read them in your local newspaper. I know you will read them in all of the science magazines. So I'm ready now for your questions, but I do have here some websites where I hope you go, not just to look for more information, but also to help us look for these gravitational waves. Thank you.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions. The LHC, for it to determine a discovery, there's zillions of data points. You're talking about 7 or 4 in 40 years. How do they compare?
Well, these are both very, very exciting experiments, but they are very different. What they need in the LHC to do those detections are zillions of collisions, because the probability of producing one event, that is the Higgs, is very low, so you need to have these many collisions and analyze all those collisions to find this event. And they have to be very high energy collisions. In our case, we do have a lot of data, but we need that data to have the noise that's really small, and the gravitational wave can be anywhere in that data. In fact, something that we're often jealous about high-energy physics experiments is, in high energy, you decide when to turn on the beam and when to make things collide. So you know when things are happening. You don't know what's happening until you see, but you know when things are happening. We don't have that luxury. We cannot shield our detector to see, this is just our noise level, and then open it up and see what changes. We just have to look at everything to see what's in there. We cannot turn off gravitational waves or on at our leisure.
Let's take a question here to my left.
These gravitational events, roughly how long do they last?
Well, There are lots of different kinds of gravitational events. For example, you probably know that galaxies have, spiral galaxies are known to have a supermassive or a very massive black hole at their center. And those black holes are often in binary systems, so sometimes you have two galaxies that are orbiting around each other, and those two black holes will collide. Those events produce gravitational waves that last millions of years. Actually, the ones that we hope to detect last tens of minutes. In our case, this binary star system, we are looking at small, what we call small stars. Those are neutron stars or small black holes that are about the mass of our sun or at most 100 or 200 times the mass of our sun. So they have been orbiting around for millions of years too, producing gravitational waves at low amplitude and very low frequency. In our detectors, we are going to see these events in the last few minutes before coalescence. So we are catching the last few minutes of this dance of the stars. This tango, I should say, since I was born in Argentina. So.
And let's go here to my right.
I sort of remember that I've seen write-ups on experiments with satellites with very long lengths for the interferometers. And sorry, I got to sneak another question in. Could you do this with clocks in space?
Well,
you know what I mean?
Yes. Lasers. We use lasers as kind of clocks. So actually, there is. A design for putting an interferometer in space, which you could call them clocks in space, but those space interferometers would be sensitive at lower frequencies, they would actually see the coalescence of these galaxies, of these black holes at centers of galaxies. There are other ideas out there about putting atomic clocks in space, however, I think the technology is not quite mature. You know, Michelson started building interferometers in 1880. It's 2013, and we are getting to the sensitivity we need. I think atomic clocks are very promising, but for the long future, they're not quite there yet. Laser interferometry in space, however, is ready to go out there, except for the funding.
Question in the back there on my left.
What's the reason for thinking that gravitational waves have the same speed as light?
Einstein said so.
Well, but
since
they've never been observed.
It is an assumption, it is a natural assumption of the theory of relativity. So it is the most natural thing to expect. However, because we are going to be measuring events that are not happening exactly simultaneously, but within a window, within all these detectors, then we should be able to measure the propagation speed of gravitational waves. We don't expect it to be different than the speed of light, but we'll measure it.
Oh, I have a question right up here.
How big is an electron?
How big is an electron? That's a very difficult question. I should ask people to know about quantum waves and particles. We don't have a good definition of the size of an electron. We say an electron is just a point. We don't say it has a size because we don't know of a way to define or measure the size of an electron. We do that, we know that for a proton, but not for an electron. That's very, very good.
Oh, we have another question at the back. Let's make this the last one.
Do we expect that gravity waves will interact with each other the way other kinds of waves do? And then that raises the question of, when they get here, have they been polluted by other gravitational waves being generated between, and that they met between their origin and our detectors?
That's a very good question. Actually, yes, they are waves. They are in space-time, but they're still waves. So all the wave phenomena that we're familiar with would happen with gravitational waves too. However, the kind of gravitational waves we're looking for are rare enough that we don't expect, we wish, but we don't expect them to be interfering with each other. There are other kinds of gravitational waves, for example, the ones produced at the beginning of the universe. They are coming from all over the sky towards Earth. They are all mixing with each other, not coherently, because they have random polarizations and random directions, but they would be all adding up to this stochastic background that would be correlated. So yes, they would interfere if you could have them aligned and at the same time, but we don't have the luxury of producing those experiments ourselves, and we don't expect them to be very common in nature.
Dr. Gonzalez, thank you very much. Pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you.